the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The flu season will soon be upon us. For most of us, it'll be a minor passing event. But upon occasion in history, the flu has inflicted serious illness and even death on more than a few people. Such was the case in 1918 and 1919 in what is known as the Great Influenza. And that will be the subject of our interview this week with the author of a new book on the subject, John Barry. Following that, Christopher Krenner, an historian at the University of Kansas School of Medicine, will tell us about a health columnist who became quite popular in the United States in the decade following the Great Influenza. And Talking History's Fiona Beattie will cap it all off with another of her sites of the week, this time on the Clendenning Library. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. Apropos the general subject of our show this week, disease, we thought it appropriate to call to your attention a recent news article in The Independent, which reports that one of history's many whodunits may be solved. As historical whodunits go, it's one of the most compelling of them all, and it deals with Alexander the Great, overlord of an ancient empire stretching from Greece to India, but who died suddenly and inexplicably at the age of just 32. For years, suspicion has fallen on poisoning as the cause of Alexander's premature death, with fingers pointed at his wife and his illegitimate half-brother, a few of his generals, and his royal cupbearer. But now, a British historian believes he has finally solved the mystery, that the killer of the greatest warlord in human history was nothing more than a humble mosquito. Andrew Chug, a respected authority on Alexander and the author of a number of books on the subject, claims he has unearthed new evidence to suggest that the Macedonian conqueror died of malaria, contracted 2 weeks before his death while sailing in the marshes outside Babylon. He plans on publishing his evidence in the coming months, so stay tuned. And Talking History takes great pride in having on its show the best, most highly regarded, and most widely read historians and writers of our day. So we're not at all surprised to see that two of the three books President George W. Bush chose to read while on vacation this past summer were written by people we had on Talking History. According to news reports, President Bush read Mark Kurlansky's Salt, A World History. Kurlansky was a guest on Talking History in July 2004 to discuss Salt, and he returned a year later to talk about his book, 1968. Bush also read The Great Influenza by our guest this week, John M. Barry. And John Barry will be with us in just a moment. This is Talking History, advisor to the presidents on summer reading. The flu that hit the United States and other parts of the world in 1918 was not just another flu. It was the Great Influenza, as it came to be known, and it caused the deaths of millions of people. John Barry has researched the epidemic and presented his findings in a new book, which he discusses this week with Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
My guest John Barry has observed, people write about war. They write about the Holocaust. They write about horrors that people inflict on people. Apparently, they forget the horrors that nature inflicts on people, the horrors that make humans least significant. One of those horrors was the worldwide flu epidemic of 1918 and 1919, which may have killed as many as 100 million people, more than died in World War II and the Holocaust. John Barry is a distinguished visiting scholar at Tulane University's Center for Bioenvironmental Research and the author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. Mr. Barry, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
There's a kind of ironic refrain that runs throughout your book. This was only influenza, just the flu. But of course, it was much more than that. What was the disease of 1918 like?
Most people that got influenza in 1918, even back then, had the same kind of the symptoms that we're familiar with today. But there was a minority, and it was not a tiny minority, that had an entirely different experience. The disease was initially misdiagnosed often as either cholera or as typhoid. is dengue, which is known as breakbone fever, give you a sense of those symptoms. From a lack of oxygen, they could turn so dark that one physician said he had difficulty distinguishing African troops from white. So some of the symptoms were even more horrific than that. People could bleed not only from their mouth and nose, but actually from their eyes and ears.
Something else about it, too, we usually think of the flu as taking away the very young and the very old. They're the most susceptible. But one of the remarkable things about 1918 and 1919 is that the young and healthy die, too, in great numbers.
That's correct. In fact, although the numbers are a little bit soft worldwide, it seems that approximately half of all the deaths, in some cases areas 60%, were young adults, people between 20 and 35 years old. And ironically, they were killed because their immune system was overreacting to the virus. It was sort of like in Vietnam, the colonel who said we had to destroy the village to save it. The immune system was throwing everything it had at this virus. And the battlefield was the lungs. And they were destroying the lungs along with their efforts to destroy the virus.
The evidence, circumstantial, you point out, but still pretty suggestive, indicates that the epidemic probably began in rural Kansas, a place we might not suspect. How did it spread so far from such an out-of-the-way place?
Well, the key was that a draftee went from Haskell County, Kansas, which is in the southwest corner of the state, down in that area where the state almost touches Texas, just separated by a narrow strip of Oklahoma. Draftee went from there to what is now Fort Riley, Kansas. And once the virus hit Fort Riley, where there were well over 50,000 troops, then it was quickly infected people in the base and from there spread easily around the world.
The influenza gets the attention of leading medical authorities when they visit Camp Devens, a military camp near Boston. The scene there alarmed even the most experienced observers. What did they see and what concerned them so much?
Well, it was really the condition of the lungs. Normally, lungs are buoyant in an autopsy. You put them in water and they'll float. These lungs sank. They were so thick with infiltrations from the immune system, from fluid and things like that. The only other lungs at autopsy that people had seen like this were actually either from pneumonic plague, which is a more violent form of bubonic plague, or from people who died from poison gas in Europe. Really, the best scientists in the world were looking at these autopsies, and initially they feared it was an entirely new disease. Camp Devens was one of the hardest hit places in the world, really, and it was one of the first hit by the violent form of the virus. Once all influenza viruses, all of them, come from birds, but the virus mutates so rapidly that gives it an opportunity to jump species from birds to people. And periodically this will happen. We're worried about bird flu in Asia now for this reason. It's not unusual for people exposed to an animal pathogen to get sick with an animal disease, but it is unusual, very unusual, for that animal pathogen to mutate in a way that it can then pass from one person to another. That happened in 1918. Generally speaking, in influenza, it's happened three or four times a century. This was therefore a different kind of influenza than people had ever been exposed to before. They saw these lungs at autopsy in Devens. They initially thought it was an entirely new disease that they had never seen before, although they pretty quickly realized it was influenza, just an extremely virulent form.
We've talked so far about the way in which the flu accompanied soldiers. It goes to Fort Riley, it goes around the world. But cities, American cities especially, get very hard hit. And Philadelphia seems to have had a particularly difficult time of it. The scenes you describe of Philadelphia in 1918 are truly gruesome. It must have been very scary.
It was a terrifying disease. And one of the key elements in the terror was the destruction of all faith and authority. And the reason for that is complicated, but it ties in with World War One, with the effort by the government to control information and to protect morale. They didn't want to say anything that was negative about anything. And therefore, they initially lied about influenza. Initially, they said this is just ordinary influenza. It's nothing to worry about. But when someone is listening to authorities reassure them that this is nothing to worry about, and they see their spouse or their neighbor die in 24 hours with horrible symptoms, turning almost black, bleeding from their eyes and ears, obviously their faith in authority disintegrates. And the terror was so extreme that many victims actually starved to death because no one healthy would go near them to feed them, and they couldn't feed themselves. There's a very serious scientist who said if this continues for a few more weeks, civilization could disappear from the face of the earth. That's the level of terror that was reached.
You write at one point in your book that the virus would test society as a whole and each element within it. Quite frankly, to read your account of things, neither the federal government nor the military seems to have met that challenge very well at all.
Well, certainly not the federal government, and very few state or local governments did. They were, again, focused on protecting morale, and their first instinct was to deny that there was a real problem, which is, of course, something we still see today. And the end result was the destruction of faith in any authority and a breakdown of society. The one segment that I focused on that actually performed not only heroically but effectively and very well were the small group of scientists, extraordinary men and one woman, who did great work during the outbreak and out of their research ultimately, although the disease struck too fast for their research to have any real effect on the disease itself. But great scientific advances did come from this research.
Your book is a fascinating story of the disease itself, but it's fascinating as well precisely because of what you've mentioned here. It's focused on a small community of scientists who struggle under enormous pressure, first of all, to identify the disease, to figure out what caused it, and then to develop a treatment for it. Who are some of those people, and what were they struggling with?
Well, to give you a sense of how significant they were, one of the characters was named William Welch. He's easily the most important person in the history of American medicine, possibly the most important person in the history of American science. I'll give you a sense of how significant he was. Years later, after the pandemic, they celebrated his 80th birthday simultaneously, linked by cable, in Berlin, Paris, London, Tokyo, Peking, Washington, Baltimore, Boston, St. Louis, in Los Angeles. And the speaker at his celebration was the President of the United States. So that'll give you a sense of his impact on American science. Probably my favorite character in the book was a man named Oswald Avery, who was almost 40 years old when he went to the Rockefeller Institute, now Rockefeller University. He went at the rank of essentially an assistant professor, really pretty low down on the totem pole. He was tremendously ambitious, but he had at that point achieved nothing, and he was confronted with this disease. Nobody knew what caused the disease at the time, and because people were dying of pneumonia, he focused on the pneumococcus. He stayed with that problem for more than 25 years, and he used to say, "Failure is my daily bread. I thrive on it." But he didn't really thrive. He often wanted to quit, throw all his experiments out the window. Ultimately, he came up with what a Nobel Prize winner called, he performed the greatest biological experiment in the 20th century. It was Avery who actually discovered that DNA carries the genetic code and launched the whole revolution of molecular biology. I mean, Jim Watson, Francis Crick, Salvador Luria, Max Delbruck, all Nobel Prize winners, all give Avery credit for launching this revolution.
What you've described here in some ways heightens the tragedy of 1918-1919, though we have the brightest scientific minds working feverishly, and yet much of the medical advice of the time is just frankly ignored by the military, for example. The military, against the advice of doctors and scientists, continues to put more soldiers in hospitals than should be there. There's a point where they overcrowd soldiers into transports going to the war in Europe.
Right. And it is a great tragedy. We were only weeks away, literally weeks away from the end of the war. And yet we're continuing, despite all the medical advice, please, not to send more troop transports over the ocean, which, you know, men packed like sardines is a perfect way to spread epidemic disease, and the military ignored this, and the appeals went directly to Wilson, and he didn't listen either. There's another incident where a train left Camp Grant in Rockford, Illinois, for another camp in Georgia, and there were 3,100 soldiers on that train, and by the time it got to Georgia, 2,000 of those 3,100 soldiers went straight from the train to the hospital, and hundreds of them died of the disease. And again, back at Camp Grant, the commander of the camp, who had ignored some very good medical advice in terms of quarantine and isolating cases to try to prevent the spread, on the day the 500th soldier at his camp died of influenza, he committed suicide, blaming himself, frankly, rightfully so, for having ignored some pretty good advice.
You described the influenza of 1918-1919 as the deadliest plague in history. Could you put that in perspective? How does it compare with other well-known plagues that people have experienced?
Well, I'm talking about the death toll. In the Middle Ages, of course, roughly a quarter of the population of Europe died. And nothing like that in terms of a percentage of the total population died in 1918-1919. However, according to a Nobel Prize winner who spent most of his life studying influenza, a minimum of 50 million people died, and he thinks it may have been 100 million. Normally in the newspapers, over 20 million, but that 20 million estimate was actually in a contemporary estimate, which was reasonably accurate for Europe and the United States, but wildly understated the death toll in the undeveloped world, which was actually hit considerably harder than the developed world. So I think today most epidemiologists would agree that an absolute rock-solid minimum of 35 to 40 million died, and it was very possibly, if not likely, closer to 100 million. Plus, the world population was only 28% as big as it is today. So in terms of absolute numbers, it's easily the deadliest plague in history, considerably more than the Middle Ages, and even considerably more than AIDS. In fact, probably more people died of influenza in 24 weeks than have died of AIDS in 24 years.
Are there any lessons to be drawn from this epidemic? Should the experience of 1918 be a source of comfort or concern for us today?
Well, I think certainly concern. It's a case study of how to deal, or really how not to deal, with an outbreak of an epidemic disease, whether it's a biological terror or whether it's a natural event. And I think one of the biggest lessons is that governments really need to tell the truth when it comes to public health issues. And while that sounds obvious and simple, it's something that really is honored more in the breach. Even last year, China lied about SARS for several months. And if SARS had been influenza, a new influenza virus, a new jumping species into man, with that head start of a couple of months, we'd have had no chance to control it, no chance to develop a vaccine for it, and a death toll would have very likely mounted into the tens of millions. And earlier in 2004, when the bird flu first erupted in Southeast Asia, again, governments were lying. Now, China lied largely for the same reasons that the U.S. lied in 1918, because they didn't want to admit anything was wrong for morale reasons. The Southeast Asian countries were hiding bird flu for economic reasons, because poultry production and export was such a large part of their economy. They were afraid to hurt that. But again, they were putting at risk, unthinkingly, the entire population of the world. So that's an important lesson. We know it, but we need to apply it.
Well, Mr. Berry, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with John Berry, the author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history.
Thank you.
The subject of our interview with John Barry was the great influenza of 1918. Our guest commentary adds to our consideration of the subject by recalling a popular health advisor in the years just following that epidemic, Logan Clendenning. Christopher Krenner is professor and chair of the Department of History and Philosophy at the University of Kansas School of Medicine.
As the flu season rolls around again this winter, we might turn for advice to the popular media. Say, Dr. Timothy Johnson on Good Morning America, or an internet site from the Center for Disease Control, or even WebMD, hoping to avoid the pop-up ads for cold remedies. Today, we stand in the lee of a 20th century explosion in popular health advice in the media. Dr. Logan Clendenning was one immensely popular advisor on health questions who followed on the heels of the 1918 flu epidemic. Clendenning was a professor of medicine at University of Kansas Medical School who emerged in the 1920s as a widely read advice columnist. At its peak, Clendenning's syndicated column, Diet and Health, reached an estimated 25 million readers in 363 daily papers. Clendenning offered his audience unimpeachably reasonable advice. He recommended fish oil in the winter to prevent rickets and fresh air and sunshine for healthy skin. Clendenning maintained an avuncular tone, faintly skeptical, but full of reassuring common sense. His advice on fighting the flu emphasized rest and plenty of grapefruit juice. It was H.L. Mencken who was probably to blame for Clendenning's career as a popularizer. Mencken saw Clendenning's lively 1924 textbook, Modern Methods of Treatment, and recognized a budding author. Clendenning had a style that was uncharacteristically pithy for a doctor. Summing up the beneficial effects of surgery, he wrote that, quote, "It separates the patient from his disease. It puts the patient back to bed and the disease in a bottle." Mencken recognized a kindred spirit. He set up Clendenning with the publisher Alfred Knopf. The result in 1927 was Clendenning's book, The Human Body. It sold 500,000 copies, offering detailed scientific descriptions in vivid, simple language. Mencken's American Mercury puffed the work as, quote, "the wittiest and most informative book on the subject of health which has been published in modern times." Today, as we wend a cautious way through the many megabytes of scares, promotions, and advertisements about health, we might consider the success of popular medical advice in the 20th century. Social critic Barbara Ehrenreich, for one, argued that the growing public visibility of medical science in the early century solidified the physician's role as an autonomous, sovereign expert. Others have seen these medical experts as hoist on their own petard. The wider availability of health information accustomed patients to act increasingly as consumers of information and services. Faced by a growing competitive market for health services in the late century, American physicians slipped a bit in status. From independent professional experts, they have been pressed more and more into the role of a hybrid between bureaucrat and vendor in an increasingly complex and politicized industry. It is surprisingly easy to picture Clendenning's column today posted on the web, flanked by ads for Viagra and Zoloft.
You've been listening to Christopher Krenner, professor and chair of the Department of History and Philosophy at the University of Kansas School of Medicine.
Just to see was my baby there. She was stretched out on a cold white table, so thin, so cool and fair. Let her go, let her go, God bless her. No matter where she may be, you can search this whole wide world over, but you never found a great big clown-faced man exactly like me.
And finally, as a follow-up to Christopher Krenner's commentary, Fiona Beatty joins us to tell us about one of the finest collections of medical history books in the United States. It's at the Clendenning Library, which is at the University of Kansas Medical Center. Our listeners may recall that the Clendenning Library provided us the recollections of T.V. Brown for our recently completed series of readings from that unpublished manuscript. Here to tell you more about the Clendenning is Fiona Beatty.
The Clendenning History of Medicine Library Museum at the University of Kansas Medical Center is home to many treasures. Dr. Logan Clendenning was an avid collector of rare medical books and artifacts. Dawn McInnes, rare book librarian, showed me a few highlights from the collection. The oldest artifact was a Roman surgical set, and the most beautiful, Leonhard Fuchs' 16th century great herbal of hand-coloured woodcuts of botanicals, including flowers, leaves and roots, to enable better identification. If you thought the pop-up book was a recent development, think again. In 1583, Georges Batiche produced an ophthalmology book. It was revolutionary for its time. Instead of Latin, it was written in German. Its most striking feature is a series of woodcut illustrations complete with movable flaps that reveal beautifully drawn sections of the brain and eye. However, belief in the mystical coexisted alongside scientific discovery.
One of the other pages was a picture of medals. They're heart-shaped, pomander-shaped, book-shaped, but these medals were actually given after the surgeries were performed to help ward off disease.
The shift to a general acceptance of science is well illustrated by the Clendenning's collection of 9 English touch pieces, small coins or medallions. Belief in the divine power of kings led to a religious curing ceremony of the king's evil, or scrofula. The monarch would lay hands on kneeling sufferers and place a touch piece around their necks. Beginning in the 11th century, the ritual remained popular until science replaced belief in the magical.
This book was printed in 1789. The preface says, "This ritual and the annex ceremonial are printed from a small volume containing them both. The formularies may, as matters of curiosity, be preserved, though the usage of them has ceased."
This is only a fraction of the extensive collection at the Clendenning Library Museum. To find out for yourself, visit clendenning.kumc.edu.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OEH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oeh.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.